Hi, everybody. We want to thank our sponsor, Legion M. They are a wonderful company. We love working with them. You can go to their website, Legion M. They're also on all the various socials. They do really fun meetups. You can talk to directors. You can become a part of the projects they choose. They even have a program right now where you can help them find great movies to support. So go to their website to learn more. We also want to remind you that we have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies.
Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You're listening to Maltin on Movies, and it's our great pleasure to have an author I really admire, not only for his writing, but for his adaptations. You may have seen some of his terrific movies like Gone Baby Gone and Shutter Island and The Drop. And Mystic River, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And, yeah.
A lot of credits, a lot of good credits. And he's got a new series starting on Apple Plus.
That we've been watching as a family. me, my mom, my dad, and my eight-month-old. I'll be honest, I don't know if she's picking up on the nuances, but it's a fantastic series.
Called Blackbird. And on Apple Plus starting, I think, tonight.
July 8th. When this airs, it will be
July tonight. July 8th. Great.
Yes. So tonight, we're going into the future.
Dennis Lehane, welcome.
Thank you guys. Thanks. Great to see you. Or hear you.
Yeah.
Now, one of the questions I have, just for starters, is the reading the credits, it says that the series was developed by you. And that's a credit I don't think very many people understand. Could you elucidate?
I don't understand either. It's some sort of leak thing. I guess if you do nonfiction, you can't say created by.
Okay.
I think that's what it is. So, because this is inspired by a true story, and
right.
I stayed as close to the facts as I could. In everything except for one trunk of the show, then, you know, they can't say I made it up. So
interesting. And I mean, and you're working with Taron Egerton. He's so, I mean, the whole cast, obviously a lot of talk because this is Ray Liotta's last work. And he's fantastic in it, which is not a surprise. But yeah. Everyone is so good. And, mm-hmm. and Taron Egerton has really kind of made more and more of a name for himself. And I think he's so talented.
And he's the right combination of, you know, we needed somebody with movie star magnetism to play Jimmy, because that, you know, Jimmy had movie star magnetism. And we needed a hungry actor.
Yeah.
And a hungry, talented actor. And Taron has that real, He's very hungry. He doesn't want to do. I'm sure he could be in the running for the, you know, young James Bond if he wanted to be. But
absolutely.
And he'll do those things. He'll kind of like, it reminds me of kind of Denzel at the early part of his career, where he kind of, you know, he dances between the commercial and then the, you know, far more risky material. And he wanted this bad, and we wanted him bad. So it was a nice marriage. Right from the get. And then he set the tone. Taron set the tone on set. From that point on, he was a consummate professional, and he was just selfless. Like, you know, I like to describe this as the perfect project, because in perfect projects, there's plenty of ego, but there's no vanity. And there's a huge difference there.
Yeah.
And everybody was the ego of the work. Everybody was so committed to telling this story, no matter what, hell or high water, the way we wanted to tell it. And that was great.
Now,
It makes me really happy because I do think Taron is so talented and I think he's going to have a long career. It makes me really happy to hear you say that because it means that he's exactly what he comes across as, you know?
Yeah, and that's very rare. I also explain to my kids, if they seem really nice, they're probably not. And if they seem like, they seem like jerk-offs, they're probably good people, you know?
Yeah.
Taron is he's an absolute gent.
Good.
And he's also an executive producer on the
series. Yeah, because when we brought him in, very quickly, he and I, there was somebody attached and Taron and I didn't think it was right for the material. And we were the ones who decided, all right, we're buddying up here and we're going to, we know this material. This is, we're the ones with hands down the most to lose here. So let's get this right. And it was an unpopular decision at the time. And we bonded together over that, I think. And then from that point on, it was like, okay, what else you got in mind? And that's how we circled in on Paul. It was between Taron and one of our producers, Bradley Thomas, who really focused on Paul. And
we're talking about Paul Walter Hauser.
And I was a fan, but I wasn't sure. I'll be dead honest, and I'm so happy I'm wrong. I wasn't sure he had the range, so I asked him to read for it, you know. And I gave him the three hardest scenes, and he blew us out of the back of the room. So that's when we were like, okay, Taron was right, Bradley was right.
All right, I'm going to ask you to do the heavy lifting here. Do a TV Guide logline synopsis of the premise of this series.
Sure. Jimmy Keene was at the time convicted and sentenced to 10 years in a minimum security prison, no possibility of parole. He was approached by the FBI and they said, we've heard you on tapes. You're very charming. We would like you to transfer to a maximum security prison specializing in the criminally insane, buddy up to a guy we think is a serial killer, and find out where some bodies are buried. If you do that, we'll commute your entire sentence, which, you know, and Jimmy at first turned down the deal. He didn't want it. It was insane. And then his father, who was the primary positive relationship in his life, his father was growing ill and he knew he would never survive 10 years with Jimmy on the inside. So Jimmy took the deal.
Now, astonishingly, at least to me, Jimmy Keene is also an executive producer on the show about his life and experience.
Yeah, Jimmy has pushed this rock up the hill for 10 years. Wow. I mean, it was at one point it was a film project slated for DiCaprio and Brad Pitt. So Jimmy has guarded, as you would if it was your life story, has guarded his life story and has done everything he can to get it to the screen. And then when I came along and sort of cracked the code, as we like to say, I worked with Jimmy extensively for a few weeks leading up to when I was going to start writing. And then I did something that's always difficult for some people, which is I then say, I'm good. I'm disconnected. I need to go into my headspace. And, so it took, I put Jimmy through some hell because Jimmy had no idea if this was going to be any good until he saw it.
Wow. This is, you know, again, it's there's so many pieces of these puzzles and more and more, I think the outside world is starting to understand how long it takes to get some things made and the amount of work that goes into it. And how God knows how many times people are attached and it doesn't, you know, something falls through or a studio's in and then they're out. It's a lot and it's a lot of work. And that is what makes it that much more special when it does happen. Also, of course, it's different now. A lot of people prefer TV for certain things because it gives you more time.
Yes.
You know, you don't have to try to squeeze everything into a movie.
And look, you know, the multiplexes, either adults left the multiplexes or the multiplexes left adults.
But at this point, some of each.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. So if you want really great, complex stories, the kind that I think of in the golden age of film, which for me was the 1970s, then, you know, you got to go to TV because you're not going to find it except the rare needle in a haystack in film.
Yeah.
So, and that's, you know, I think the wake up call for a lot of people, at least the wake up call for me, let me just say the wake up call for me, the shocking wake up call for me was when I was wrapping up watching Breaking Bad in its moment. And I thought, nothing's ever been this good on television. And I'm not sure anybody's writing novels this urgent right now that speak to the culture in the same way that Breaking Bad spoke to sort of the emasculation of the white American male, if you will, you know? Mm. And I just thought, this is where I want to be. This is what I love. Because it's like a novel. It's
yeah,
it unfolds slowly. And what's that?
What's been interesting, because obviously this is a conversation that comes up a lot now, is mm-hmm. so many different things, like probably the Hobbit series, Lord of the Rings in general, and Harry Potter, if it was happening today, they would have been series and not movies. And it's, you know, that's, and it's just, as I say, it just fascinates me, because obviously growing up in a household that loves movies, for us all to be a part of this shift where we're realizing that television offers what it does, and speaking to creative folks like yourself, where you have the opportunities you do. You know, mm-hmm. It's just kind of amazing.
Yeah. I was talking to somebody, just last week about, I have this obsession and this theory, which I've tried to confirm, and it's never been confirmed, but about the French Connection, the film, The French Connection, is one of my favorite films, is actually an Americanization, not an American, it's kind of an update of Moby Dick. And then it's very much about, the point of the entire movie is not whether you get the guy or you don't get the guy. It's about the price of obsession and to some extent class rage. And so you have a movie. I'm sorry, I'm going to do a spoiler. I don't need a spoiler alert for a movie that's 50 years old, but, but you know, French Connection ends with him running towards a room where the quote unquote bad guy is, runs into the room, the screen goes black. You hear a gunshot. You have no idea what the hell happened. You just have zero idea. And you think, you can never make that now, except on television. Nobody could make the French Connection now, unless you made it on television.
Yeah.
Because that's got a morally ambiguous ending. It's got an extremely kind of borderline despicable lead character. And, you know, and it's, you know, I mean, he has like sex with like a 15-year-old girl in the movie. You know, he picks up on the street, you know? It's absolutely, you know, it's, you could never do it today, but you could do it. This is where the morally ambiguous stuff has gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a film that after almost, well, it is half a century, plays absolutely perfectly today. Because my wife and I watched, actually, we were channel surfing and it was on and we couldn't turn away.
Mm. No, it's that documentary style. It's that, oh my, it's the sound. I think the sound mix is astonishing. It's Hackman. That movie does not make a single mistake.
No, no, indeed. I want to ask you a couple of nuts and bolts questions.
Sure.
So you have this book that you're working with as your basic source material, enhanced and augmented by your conversations with Jimmy Keane. How do you decide how many parts you're going to split it into? This happens to be a 6-part. Now, as they call it, limited series. Why 6? Why not 8? Why not 4?
It wouldn't make 8. 4 is always my instinct. And then, you know, it's my instinct to go shorter rather than longer.
Mm-hmm. Bless you.
But I find out actually that I need to be reined in. I need to slow down. My first instincts are too fast. Mm-hmm. They're always too fast. And I always go through a process on every show I've ever worked on, where I gotta take a breath and realize that's not one episode, that's 2 episodes. Mm. That's not, you know, you need to breathe and for the power to build. So this was originally 5 episodes.
Mm.
And everybody, all my producing partners, Apple, everybody kept conspiring against me, pushing me to write this episode I did not want to write. And it held until it was placed in there as I'll get to it. And then I wrote it right before I think we hit set. And it was the fourth episode. It's not the sixth, it's the fourth. And it was an episode that everybody wanted to sort of, let's all take a breath and have us get to really know these guys. Let's go through and tell the story of how they grew up and have them begin to interact in a different way. Almost as if they're playing therapist patient for each other, depending on who's speaking. And I wrote the episode and I hated the episode and I turned it in and everybody flipped over, particularly Paul. Paul loved it. And then I saw it. And then I was like, I was wrong. I like being wrong. I really like being wrong. I got no problem with it. I was like, damn, I was wrong. This episode works. I'm glad everybody pushed me. It's exactly what the show needed, because the show was just hitting such a crescendo at that point. Episode three ends in possibly the scariest and darkest place for Jimmy, not psychologically, but physically. He's in a lot of danger at the end of three.
And not exactly a joyride for us in the audience either.
Right. And then it was just kind of like, it was almost like bowling. It was the time to just reset the pins, you know, all reset the pins, just take a break. Even though my break is a riot. let's take a break. And let's roam around with these characters. Let's show their past. And that ultimately worked out. But I was just taught so strongly, I studied kind of screenwriting through studying the playwriting of David Mamet, and Mamet is very anti-backstory. So yes. I'm almost, but this was the place to do it.
Yeah.
Now, the other question is, How do you turn over the reins to another writer for an episode or a couple of episodes?
Well, I'm okay with that. As a showrunner, you realize the final voice is going to be yours. The filter, I'm a coffee filter, and no matter what you write, just as David Simon and Ed Burns were for me on The Wire, just as Terry Winter was on Boardwalk Empire for me, the ultimate voice of any TV show in this period is the showrunner. And so if a screenwriter breaks away from, you know, your voice, you just bring it back in. You know, that's what goes through your filter at the very end. That means that, you know, the Rick and Sean, who wrote episode three, did a bang up job. I just did touch ups so that it still sounds like me. Still sounds like my people. And David used to do that. We used to do on The Wire, we'd be like, David, I have no idea what to say here. It's so Baltimore. And he'd be like, yeah, and I'm Baltimore. Don't worry about it. Just write and put parentheses and I'll fill it in, you know?
Well, I will confess to you that it always was a pebble in my shoe, you might say, that I'd never seen The Wire. And it was the first thing my wife and I decided to do when lockdown came.
Oh, okay, good.
The pandemic gave us that gift. We watched all five seasons. Is it five? Yeah.
Yeah, it's five.
Starting with number one, and 10 minutes in, I understood why people refer to it as possibly the greatest television series that ever was. No disrespect to Breaking Bad, but
it's a nice argument to be in. There's like five shows. And to be associated with one of those five is an honor. And I had nothing to do in terms of authorship. I was brought in, as I say, to paint a room. The house was already built. They just said, you paint that room Dennis Lehane magenta. And I was like, okay. And that's how I feel about The Wire. I was a cog in the wheel. I was very proud to be a cog in the wheel. But that was David and Ed Burns' show all the way.
There's an element, I think, in most shows of that, that reveal that kind of depth, that kind of layering. There's an element of collaboration and writing. Traditional writing is a very solitary business, a solitary pursuit. Tell us a little about learning to collaborate.
I loved it. I think my personality has never been a particularly like most writers that I know. I don't like solitude. I don't like people. I'm a social being. It's funny. My brother is an actor, and he has a writer's personality.
Hmm.
I'm a writer, and I think I have an actor's personality. When we got into Do the Wire, you know, in terms of collaboration, here's how it works at the beginning. And thank God, you need to do your 10,000 hours. I don't care which aspect of writing you're in. If I came from novels. So mm-hmm. I showed up, I started writing screenplays for The Wire. My first script, I think 40% of it got on screen.
It's so interesting what you're saying about different kinds of personalities and how, as you say, you know, for some folks, I mean, even talking about the pandemic, my dad's a writer and he's used to getting himself up to write. Yeah. So where for some folks not going into an office really was sort of detrimental because that was their, you know, that's what they're used to doing. For him, we just started giving him assignments.
Right.
You know, right. And we said, okay, we'll start working on this or work on that. And every day he's able to get himself up and do it. And again, that's why, like with anything, you have to have certain skills and it has to work for you.
Yes.
You know, and that's, so when, I mean, just to go back, when did you start writing?
I started writing very young. I started writing in third grade. And then, but where I came from, it just wasn't a viable career option. Nobody did it.
Of course.
When I was 20, I just realized I'm just not good at anything else. I mean, I dropped out of two colleges, safety majors, and my parents were freaking out because they didn't have a lot of money. And they just wanted one of their kids to graduate from college. And I was the last hope. And I finally said, look, the only way this is going to work is if I can go somewhere and just concentrate on becoming a writer, not a journalist, not a teacher,
sure.
A writer. And they said, well, you know, you pretty much suck at everything else, so why not?
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Dorchester, Massachusetts.
Oh, my.
Before the Wahlbergs.
Before,
before the Wahlbergs made it famous. So
that's very funny.
I then took it. I think the greatest thing about growing up that way,
yeah,
is something I know that I can never give my kids is there was absolutely no safety net. Mm. So it removed the dilettante factor. If I failed, I was done. I was toast. And
yeah.
I would end up bartending at Vaughn's on Dot Ave and having somebody scream like, Hemingway, bring me another beer. And I had a focus that,
yeah,
even now my friends from college talk about. I just had this insane focus. I ate, drank, and slept writing theory.
Wow.
Not literary theory, but writing theory.
Yeah.
And I just read and read and read. And I'd been a movie fanatic since my sister took me to Oliver when I was four. And it was such a dark, dark, quote unquote, children's movie.
Oh yeah.
That I was all in, man. Was all in. So I've loved, it's weird to me that I didn't end up a screenwriter. I think the only reason I didn't end up a screenwriter off the top, you know, right off the bat,
yeah,
to go to film school, was because that would be like saying I'm going to become an astronaut. It just seemed so far removed from the world I grew up in.
Yeah.
That, you know, pens don't cost much. Film equipment costs a ton.
Right. Well, that when my mom always says that when she came home with my dad and she explained that he was a writer, they said, so he teaches?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
He was like, yeah, he teaches, because it's just, it is, it's something foreign. And I mean, I'm glad that you were able to, obviously it's worked out okay for you.
Yes,
I'm glad that you were able to continue doing it. But it's also, I think it's also really special when you do have a calling. And when there is something that you're just like, no, this is the thing that I do, you know?
Yeah. And the best thing is there's something clarifying about lack of options.
Yeah.
I wasn't good at anything else. There was literally nothing else I was good at.
I understand.
I was just good at making stuff up. That was
sure.
It. So when all my friends were, you know, getting jobs as stockbrokers and lawyers and all that, it wasn't on the table for me.
Yeah.
I had to just go for broke for this. And And I remember when I first came back out of graduate school, and my mother would be like talking to son, "Oh, what's your son doing? Oh, he just got, you know, he just made junior partner at this law firm. Oh, he's parking cars." You know, that was me out of grad school. And
when I say I understand, I genuinely mean
got it.
Understand.
So it was nice a few years later. I was like, you know, somebody, my mother would say, you know, "The next door neighbor read your books." "I can't believe you're that Dennis Lehane." And I was like, "There you go." So that was fun.
Did she cut out? I found when my grandmother died, I found this book where she cut out all the newspaper clippings.
Every single newspaper clipping.
I love that.
I got a big, huge photo album.
I love that. Yeah. No, it is amazing. It is nice. And it is amazing when you get to do that, when you get to say, okay, yes, I know that I didn't follow the path that was necessarily ideal. But now, as you say, now the next door neighbor can say they read my book.
Yeah.
No, it's great if it works out.
Yeah.
Were you always an observer?
Yes. I think I was, you know, my next, and I believe my final book, which will come out in the spring.
Don't say final.
It feels like it might be. I feel
you're
like
too young. You're too young to say things like final.
I mean, like I'm going to just do TV.
Oh, they're fine.
But it feels final. But it's about the busing crisis in Boston in the summer of 1974. And that was formative. I was 9 years old. And I think that it was so shocking and so violent and so confusing for a little kid. And I was right on the front lines that it was the formative event of my life. It was the formative global event of my life, if you will. And and from that point on, I was very observant because I was fascinated with people, because the same people I saw in church the next day were throwing rocks at buses.
Yeah.
And you know, it was baffling and bewildering. And it formed a very early, I remember my first political thought, socio-political thought, I think probably by around 11, was that I was like, why are the blacks and whites? I grew up on a neighborhood that was in between a 100% white neighborhood and a black neighborhood. And I was right in the middle. And I formulated a thought very young that it seems that it's in the best interest of the people with money to keep the people without fighting amongst themselves.
Hmm.
And that was my earliest conscious political social thought. I haven't strayed from that since. And I was 11.
Wow.
Kids, now, kids get it.
I was about to ask what may now be a redundant question, but why do you think Boston is such a cauldron of story material?
Great
characters. I don't see that with Pittsburgh or Denver or Kansas City. I mean, they all have their stories to tell, but Boston seems to be, you know, in a class by itself.
There's something spiky about us. I know that for sure. I think everybody in Boston, I try to explain it to people, but I really feel that everybody in Boston, and by Boston, I mean the inner city, the ring around what's called the hub. Everybody's just a little bit nuts. I don't know how else to describe it, but I'll give you the most benign version of it. That I was once in a bathroom at Fenway Park. It was jammed, absolutely jammed. Everybody was waiting to get into a toilet. And it was the middle of a baseball game. And all of a sudden, from the back of this massive crowd, this guy starts singing Coca Cabana by Barry Manilow.
Mm-hmm.
"My name is Rico. And then he gets to the "But Who Shot Who?" And the entire room explodes into "At the Copa." I just thought, that's my city. That's never happened in any other place. We're just a little bit off. And funny as hell. I mean, I've never met anybody who's half as funny as some of the guys I grew up with. And that includes all comedians. So I think there's something to that. There's something to the amount of the packed real estate, that it's just really a small city. It's the exact same size as Milwaukee. And the college influence being, you know, 9 months out of the year, we have the class range set up very simply. On one side of the river is Harvard, on the other side of the river is Boston and the neighborhoods. We have the Brahmins, we have the history of anti-Irish hatred, then the Irish have the history of anti-African-American hatred, and the, you know, it just goes on and on. So there's just so many stories. Mm. And so long until very recently, it was incredibly balkanized. That you could say, you could name any neighborhood to me 20 years ago, and I could tell you what 98% of the ethnic makeup was. Hmm. It was easy. Oh, that's the Italian section. Oh, that's the Greeks. That's the Brazilians. That's the African Americans. That's the Haitians. That's the Cape Verdeans. Like, it was literally that balkanized. And now it's much less balkanized, thank God. So maybe the stories will start to dry up.
Mm. I hope not. Because Ben Affleck did such a fine job on Gone Baby Gone.
Certainly did.
And besides the obvious components of any good movie, he seemed to cast his extras and day players out of the bars. They all looked real. Everybody looked genuine.
He did a few things for Gone Baby Gone. One is he not only shot it in Dorchester, but Dorchester is quite big. It'd be the equivalent of, say, Brooklyn. It's very big. And it's comprised of parishes, Catholic parishes. And when I was a kid, there were 32. Now I think it's down to like 16. But but anyway, you know yourself by your parish. You know your area by your parish. Mm. He shot Gone Baby Gone 100% in my parish, where I grew up, where the events happened, where the book happens. So that was extremely important. The other thing he had said, I saw this in an interview, he never said it to me, but I was struck by his casting. For a first-time director, I was just struck by how picture-perfect everybody in the film was. Hmm. And I heard him give an interview in which he said when he was in the film Changing Lanes, which is arguably the best performance anybody's ever pulled from him, he spoke to the director, and the director said, if you ever direct, cast your smallest part like your largest.
Yep.
Oh, that's a great piece of advice.
Yep.
That is exactly what we did. It's exactly what I did on Blackbird. I cast Blackbird soup to nuts, and I would sit there at night. I couldn't believe how much pleasure I took in it, but I would go home. I would sit at night after a day on the set. I'd sit down, make myself a drink, and I would start watching audition tapes. Mm. And I would just go through them over and over. Sometimes I drove Alexa, my casting director, crazy. Until I was like, she's like, you got to make a decision. It's one line. And I'm like, it's an important line. You know what I mean?
It makes all the, in the same way that great background actors do not detract, it's the same thing that if something is wrong, it's wrong and it's glaring.
It's glaring.
You know, all it takes is that one person to do something that you go, why are they doing that?
We had one casting mistake, and it was because I was excessively tired. Mm. I was in a rush, and there was a lot of conflict on the set at that point. It just every film has conflict. Mm-hmm. And I just pulled the trigger on something without taking my due time.
Huh.
And I had to cut around it in editing.
Wow.
Huh. Lesson learned or lesson relearned.
Yeah.
Relearned.
But hey, I have to say something that we value deeply is getting to interview a lot of those kinds of actors, the ones that are not above the title, folks like Dale Dickey, you know, people like that who make your film or make your TV show without them.
Yeah. No, without them, you don't have, my God, no. I'll give you a perfect example. We had a Chris, I can't remember his last name, the guy who plays Jimmy's psychiatrist inside the prison.
Mm-hmm.
He got COVID just before he was supposed to shoot. And they were like, you got to recast. And Taryn and I said, we're not recasting that guy. That guy's awesome. Mm. We'll juggle the schedule. We'll figure it out. We'll work around it until he comes back because we loved him. And we were like, that's an act. That's a great actor. You don't just swap him out for somebody else to play a psychiatrist. You know, that's our guy. So.
Mm. Well, and that is what time does, is time. I think you've done this enough to know when you want to fight and which hills you want to die on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, It makes, I think, a really, really big difference. What was it like your first time?
Get involved with people you don't have to fight. Get involved with people who respect, you know.
Absolutely. What you're yes. Well, obviously you selected the director who did such a good job on your movie, The Drop.
Mm-hmm.
Is it Mikhail Roskam?
Mikhail Roskam. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, Mikhail did a bang up job on the first three. Then Jim McKay came in. Mm-hmm. And shot the bottle, what we call the bottle episode, which is the mm-hmm. riot episode. And then Joe Chappelle just crushed the final two. It was a joy. It really was. And so, yeah, and Apple TV Plus was, my God, they were just so supportive, and they gave us such freedom.
Isn't that great?
And, you know, there was some commerce involved. You know, there was a moment right near the beginning of the shoot where they were like, oh, yeah, we got to cut a whole bunch out of your budget. And we were like, mm-hmm. But yeah. That's life.
Excuse me.
That's life. So it's probably all downhill from here because it was a golden experience.
Wow. Can you talk a little bit about Mr. Mercedes?
Sure. Mercedes was, David Kelly asked me in to meet him. I took a meeting with David on another project that we're only now getting to, which is set in Dublin. And while we were there, he was gearing up for Mr. Mercedes. And I said, what are you doing? He said, Mr. Mercedes. I said, oh, I love that book. He was like, you want to come on? I was like, really? And I came on, and David and I very quickly in the room, it was a very strange room. It was in his offices. It was kind of like there was no real dedicated office. We're kind of in the waiting area. And after, I think the first week, he was like, look, you got a real great feel for this. I've already written, we've got the first two in the bag. I wrote them. Why don't you just run with this? And I was like, sure. So I took it from there and did the last, you know, eight episodes as a kind of de facto writer's room showrunner, you know. And then season two, we were really saddled with a difficult book in some ways. It was what attracted me to Mr. Mercedes was there was nothing woo woo in it. There was nothing horror. There was nothing fantastic in it. It was this very straight, simple police story.
Right.
I saw it as a way to look at the Rust Belt. I saw it as a way to look at the sort of the white America that is committing suicide at an alarmingly high rate and votes for Trump. That was what I wanted to look at in Mr. Mercedes.
Yeah.
And season two, we got saddled, I think, with material that was, you know, it was just not, I'm totally honest about my limitations. I didn't feel like it was 100% something that I ever got a hold of.
Sure.
So I handed it back to David for season three. And I was just like, I'm out, you know, like I'm just moving on. And then I went off and did another Stephen King book, which was baffling to me. So I did The Outsider.
Have you discussed your adaptations with Stephen King?
Yeah, we've talked a little bit about it. He sent me a lovely note that I framed about the first season of Mr. Mercedes. And yeah. I told him exactly what I told Jimmy Keane, which is at some point I'm going to have to pick this ball up and run with it. And I won't be checking. Like I won't be, you know, he said, I don't want to breathe over your shoulder. And I'm the same way. Whenever I've been adapted, if I know the writer gets what I'm doing, I stay the hell out of their way. I don't bother them. I say, see, here's my cell phone. If you want me, call me. Hmm. Otherwise I'll see you at the premiere, you know?
It's amazing.
So.
Well, I am a huge, huge fan of the Treadway brothers, both Luke and Harry. And I've loved them for years. They're in a fantastic, very strange, but fantastic movie called Brothers of the Head. And that's how I first found them. and they are identical twins. And they both work a lot and just fantastically talented.
Yeah. And Harry was lovely. He's a lovely to work with.
But that's it. And Harry is so, God, because he's so creepy and he's so good in Mr. Mercedes. Again, you have a killer cast, fantastic cast in Mr. Mercedes.
Yeah, I mean, we had Brendan, we had, I mean, it was a terrific cast. So,
you also teach writing.
Not anymore.
Not anymore. How long did you teach?
I run two, I'm behind, I'm the man behind the man of two writers conferences that, and I teached. Oh my God. I done teached. I taught at, I've taught at Tufts. I've taught at Harvard. I've taught at Eckerd College, which is my alma mater. I've taught in writing programs, large and small. My favorite without a doubt was Harvard Extension, which is for returning students. And I had just a crew of, I would much rather teach either an extension program or a graduate school level if I had the time. There's a dilettante factor that I don't think existed 30 years ago in writing programs. There's a lot of people in there who don't read books.
Yeah.
Which is absolutely crazy. I'm like, this is like saying I want to be a doctor because I watch a lot of ER. I mean, this is stupid. And you can't get through to them. So it's like, what if what you really want to do is write a screenplay, go write a screenplay. And you're going to find out how bad you are at that. So I just stopped after a while. It was just getting too frustrating. And yeah. I had a student who I adored. She's one of my all-time favorite students. And she blew up at a kid in class. She said, I mean, what's wrong with you, man? I take this effing seriously. And I was like, I almost cheered her in that moment. And that's when I was like, it's time to go. It's time to go. So.
Well, look, it's you know, when someone tells me they love movies and they refer to old movies as the 90s, I get a little violent. It's just what happens to me. When something is your passion and something is something that you care about so deeply, and then other people come around and sort of just don't give a shit, it's very hard.
Yeah, it's frustrating. So it's like, don't be there. You know, just don't be there.
Yeah.
So when I you know, the most joyous class I ever taught was certainly this class. I taught it for 2 years at Harvard Extension, and it was the advanced fiction class for returning adults. And it was, it produced a couple of really great writers, a guy named Charlie Haverty, who's a terrific short story writer. And it was just a joy. It was a joy to come in and just have people who were just like there to work. And that's the thing here with Blackbird. That was the same thing, which was I remember when Ray came on the set, people were nervous, very nervous.
Yeah.
And if you didn't have an A game, you should be nervous.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you were full of it, you should be nervous. And I remember Ray would ask these really tough questions. And if he got word salad for an answer, God help you. You know what I mean? God help you. He was like, no, that's not what I asked. You know, that's not the answer. You don't know what you're talking about.
I love it.
And I loved that.
I love it.
I always knew what I was talking about. Or if I didn't, I have no problem saying, I don't know.
Yeah.
Let me look it up. Let me go find out. I'll figure it out. So that was I loved working with Ray Liotta. I absolutely loved it because of that. Because he's an all pro, and he was in there
as
all
pro.
And his performance really is, I mean, first of all, completely believable.
Yeah.
Believable, but also so good.
Yeah.
So good.
No, he is that you're not thinking Ray Liotta, you're thinking that character.
No.
He did something that was just great. I mean, Taryn and I were talking about just last night. He came on set the first day to shoot a scene with Taryn. And again, Ray was not, he was not fuzzy. He was not cuddly.
Yeah.
He was there to work. And then he sees Taryn, walks across what was our visitation room. And he gives him this huge hug. And he established the father-son relationship right there.
Wow. Right there. Wow.
So.
And Taryn is still fairly young in the business.
Yeah, yeah.
And to have Ray Liotta make that gesture, talk about meaningful.
Yeah.
It was. It really was. It was. And he's just a mensch, man. We miss him so much.
I know.
And we were supposed to work together on the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And he was the last conversation I had with him. It was such an actor conversation. He was like, so what are you doing next? And I tell him. And he says, you got a part in there for me? And I said, of course I do. He says, you make it a big part.
I love that so much. That, Ray Liotta, God bless you.
Yeah.
And how dare you leave us too soon, but at least we have so much. And I am thrilled. I'm thrilled that he's in your series because I do believe people are going to get to see it. And I think that they're going to be reminded of why folks will continue to speak about him with so much reverence.
And an extra cheer for Paul Walter Hauser.
Oh, man.
Who, you know, is not an everyday actor. He's not an actor who is easily cast. Mm-mm. If you saw him in Clint Eastwood's movie, Richard Jewell, playing the alleged bomber of the Atlanta Olympic Games, I, Tanya.
He's in I, Tanya. No, he's done a lot, and he's on TV series. He's an incredibly talented guy. And my favorite thing is that when you do see him interviewed, he is nothing like those roles. And it's how you know that he's an actor.
He did it. I'll leave you with this nice anecdote.
Yeah.
Paul, we'd come over. Paul and my wife grew up in very not far from each other in Michigan. My wife's from Grand Rapids. He's from Saginaw. So he would come over for Michigan food. We would do this like really nasty, like really dumpy food that
perfect
I grew up on. And then we had to have RC Cola. So he would come over to the house, you know, about once a week. And then one time he came over when Cruella was out, and my 9-year-old daughter and him sat in our living room, and they watched Cruella together. My 9-year-old daughter got to watch Cruella with Paul Walter Hauser, who's in Cruella. And then the next day we go to set, and he delivers one of his more nasty Larry monologues. And I was like, I got pictures of you sitting on a couch with my daughter and looking like all cute and cuddly. And now I wouldn't let you near my dog.
Right.
That was the level of, you know, artistry that was on display there. It was great. Yeah.
It's called acting, man.
That's it. Boy. Yeah.
And some people have a gift.
They do.
As you do for writing, Dennis. Okay. And I would say writing and now producing as well.
Yep.
Thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you guys so much. I'm so glad. Anything you can do to get the word out on this show is just so greatly appreciated. This was our labor of love.
Absolutely. Look, honestly, when I tell you that it's when you can get all of us as a family sitting and silent, you know, watching this and can't wait for the next one. I don't just say that, truly. It's so good. And I really do think people enjoy is a funny word with some certain series. You understand what I mean? But
No, that's a thing. There's David Mamet again, and his book on writing goes to this great point to say that our job is to delight, but delight, he breaks delight into like four different permutations of what delight means.
Yes.
And it's not to make you happy. It's to, you know, sort of invigorate you as a viewer.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's delight.
Yeah.
And that's what I always set out to do. That's something that I do try to say, even with this show. This show is about a lot of things, particularly it's about toxic masculinity. But if you don't get that on the first viewing, I'm okay with that. Mm-hmm. Because what I want to do first is delight you. I want to take you on a journey, and then I want to toss you out the car at the very end. And I want you to go, whoa, what happened? Ah. And then if you start thinking, there seems to be a lot of things in there about, you know, the male gaze or what have you, you know, which is really the last shot of our show is literally the male gaze on the stewardess as she walks away and then he looks out a window. So it's if you don't get that the first viewing or even any viewing, I'm okay with it.
Yeah.
Because I want to delight you first. I want to tell a story.
You succeed times 12, truly. Yeah. And thank you so much for your time. And it's a real pleasure to get
to meet you, Leonard. It's a real honor.
Thank you. That's very flattering. I appreciate those kind sentiments. And continued success, sir. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Well, we don't get to talk to writers often enough.
And being that writing is your passion.
Yeah.
Writing is something that you love. And
reading.
And reading, yeah.
Both of those pursuits. And
let me just, people ask my dad all the time, how do I get to do what you do? To this day, this is a question that comes up, and I will say the same thing over and over again. Read as much as you can about film. Read everything. Read every book. Read every biography, autobiography. Read everything, because the more information you have, the smarter you are, which should be an obvious, you know, but it's true. Watch as many movies as you can. Because what makes a good critic is someone who has comparison, someone who can say, okay, I've seen this done like this, but I like seeing this done like that. You know, make yourself an educated viewer, an educated reader, and you know, it'll also make you a better person, won't it?
it definitely will.
Yep.
Oh, thank you, sweetie.
Yeah. Well, hey, you know what? So the last thing I'm going to say, something my dad always tells me is he never wants to be the most interesting person in a room.
I want to meet interesting
people. I want to meet interesting people. Well, make yourself one of those, you know?
I'll leave with this. When I was a kid, and I mean a kid, I saw on my local PBS station a round table with four successful authors. And each one was asked for advice to young and aspiring writers. And Max Schulman, the humorist who wrote The Many Affairs of Dobie Gillis and Barefoot Boy with Cheek, which is a joke that some people get and some people don't, and a lot of other things, said, marry money. It's actually a wonderful and honest piece of advice for aspiring writers. You don't go into this to get rich, because
that's not what's going to happen.
No. The James Pattersons are few and far between.
Yeah.
Anyhow, we're so happy that we got this opportunity. And this mini series, limited series.
Oh, whatever the hell you want to call it.
This 6-episode
yes.
saga is very compelling.
Excellent. And I hope that you'll take a watch, because I think it's worth your time.
Yep.
You ready to make a terrible segue? Go on.
Yeah. And if people have other time to spare and they want to be in touch with us or keep up with what we're doing, how do they go about that?
Sure. I'm at Jesse Malton. You are at Leonard Malton on Twitter and Instagram. You're also on Facebook. You can also go to YouTube, where we're Malton on Movies. We do a live stream every week talking about movies, answering your questions. Join in. It's a good time.
Sunday afternoons.
And then, of course, there's what I call Maltreon, the Patreon.
Patreon.com/Malton on Movies is where you can show your support for what we do and to help us keep on doing it.
And we appreciate it very, very much.
And we have various ways to say thank you for your contributions. So that about wraps it up. And we'll see you folks next time. Take care. Today's episode of Malton on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.